This meant that they were always at a disadvantage when meeting and handling agents in high-risk or denied areas. Agents had to communicate with their handlers, and defeating surveillance was the key to their protection. Whenever OTS developed a new gadget or disguise that offered an advantage against the ever-present watchers, it would be only a matter of time before its tactical superiority was lost. There had to be a better way for agents to operate and communicate without exposing themselves to hostile surveillance, and for OTS, the new technology arrived in the form of digital zeros and ones. Chapter 24. Covert Communications. We are surrounded by a world of secret communications. Eric Cole, Hiding in Plain Sight. America's intelligence services, CIA, FBI, and some military elements recruited foreign spies with the access and opportunity to procure, which is to say, steal, secret information considered vital to U.S. national security. However, without an ability to communicate securely with his handler, the spy and his purloined secrets are worthless. Spies were most vulnerable to being caught not while procuring the information, but when attempting to pass their secrets to a third party. Every agent required his own tailored COVCOM that fit his circumstances and the kind of information he collected. A film cassette filled with photographs of classified memos represented a different COVCOM problem than passing printed pages of a radar system's operating manual or the actual circuit board from a missile guidance system. Information exchanges between agent and handler must be both secure and secret. Codes and ciphers provide levels of security, while digital steganography hides the encrypted information in a cloak of electronic invisibility. In the last half of the 20th century, the holy grail of COVCOM was envisioned as a secure system of two-way, reliable, on-demand exchange of voice, text, and data 24/7 from and to any location. The message need not necessarily be encrypted, but the communication process must present a low probability of detection and interception. Once concluded, the exchange would leave no record of having occurred or any telltale electronic footprint. Such a system would be used from anywhere to anywhere in the world for an agent to talk to his handler, CIA headquarters, or even the President of the United States. Every CIA COVCOM system, from the personal meeting between handler and agent to a multi-million-dollar satellite link between an agent and the DCI, consisted of three primary segments: the field set, what the agent used either to receive or send, the transmission backbone, such as shortwave, high-frequency broadcasts that carried the message, and the receiving element. Personal meetings between agent and handler required comparatively less technology, while COVCOM through satellites was dependent on technology. Regardless of the system, each involved integrating whatever special devices were needed with sound tradecraft at every stage of system development, delivery, and in the case of the agent, concealment of incriminating equipment. The fewer pieces of spy gear in the agent's possession and the fewer unnatural acts he had to perform operationally, the lower was his risk of being detected. Through the years, the CIA's Office of Communications, Office of Research and Development, Office of Development and Engineering, and Office of Technical Service each pursued some element of COVCOM's holy grail. Their efforts resulted in the deployment of successive generations of technically sophisticated gear that advanced one or more of the following imperatives: obtain more timely information, improve security, pack the maximum amount of information into an exchange, and deliver intelligence ever more quickly to the end user. When selecting a covert communication system, the case officer considered factors such as the agent's lifestyle, profession, ability to travel abroad, and risk tolerance. He estimated how frequently the COVCOM would be used, the size and aggressiveness of the local counterintelligence service, level of surveillance directed against the handler, and the number and types of COVCOM systems already operating in the area. Regardless of the variables, two general categories of COVCOM occurred between agent and handler: personal and impersonal. Each category of COVCOM has advantages as well as risks. Personal meetings between an agent and handler, often a U.S. official, represent the riskiest form of COVCOM. Hostile governments conducted routine surveillance of foreign diplomats under the assumption that some of them were actually intelligence officers operating under official cover. Persons suspected of having an intelligence affiliation were systematically surveilled to detect signs of clandestine activities, such as clearing and filling dead drops or meeting an agent. The agent, unless already under investigation, was less likely than the American to be under surveillance, but if observed in an unauthorized meeting with a foreign official, immediately was suspect and placed under surveillance. Despite the risk, face-to-face meetings were frequently a preferred means of communication with agents. Exchange of materials was assured, conversations could address urgent issues, conflicts could be ironed out, and the agent's morale given a boost. During personal meetings, the handler was always alert for changes in the agent's attitude, motivation, personality, and health. He was able to conduct hands-on agent training, modify requirements, change operational plans, and gauge firsthand the extent of any counterintelligence problems. Given the inherent risks, however, personal meetings in denied areas were kept to a minimum, carefully planned, and never conducted without a specific reason. The handler was always prepared for the contingencies necessary to maintain the security of the operation. Meeting times, duration, and locations were selected to provide a plausible cover story for both handler and agent in case they were observed. The agenda for the meeting was scripted in advance. Initial greetings were immediately followed by a standard question, "How much time do you have?" Next on the script was to agree on arrangements for the next meeting, should they be interrupted. To minimize the counterintelligence exposure of an agent being spotted during a personal meeting, the CIA developed techniques known as brief encounters. These involved a personal contact between the agent and handler, but minimized the length of time required for an exchange of material. In 1958, the CIA chief of station in Prague, Haviland Smith, developed a technique of a brush contact or brush pass while providing tradecraft training in New York City to a Czech agent. Smith noticed that the agent was reluctant to leave his package of secrets in a dead drop for fear it would be discovered and traced back to him. As an alternative, Smith had the agent stand just inside the entrance to the Grand Central Terminal, where a person entering had the option of proceeding straight ahead to the old Biltmore Hotel or turning right and descending down a flight of stairs to the subway. Smith knew that at that point he would be momentarily out of sight of any trailing surveillance. If an agent was waiting at the top of the stairs and just inside the entrance, Smith could pass a newspaper to the agent, who would quickly turn around and head down into the subway, while Smith proceeded straight ahead into the hotel. It worked so well that, in a training exercise, even when the surveillance team was looking for the move, as long as they were following Smith from behind, the pass could not be detected. Only in the unlikely chance that the hostile surveillance team had somehow anticipated Smith's travel path and arrived ahead of him could the exchange be spotted. The counterintelligence surveillance team was never certain where Smith, who varied his routes and timing, was going and could not set up on him in advance. Case officers and techs identified similar locations in cities around the world where the same technique could be used. In a variation of the brush pass, the moving car delivery technique allowed an agent to drop a package covertly into the handler's slowly moving vehicle through an open window. The travel route selected by the handler was consistent with his normal evening routine and included a number of right-hand turns on dimly lit side streets. Following each right-hand turn, the handler's vehicle was out of sight of the trailing surveillance vehicle for a few seconds. The CIA referred to this brief window of time as being in the gap. The agent was instructed to stand in the shadows at the corner and watch for the handler's car to complete the turn. When the car was briefly out of sight, or in the gap, just following the turn, the driver would dim the car's lights as a signal to the agent. The agent then stepped to the curb and dropped the package through the open window. Immediately after making the exchange, the agent receded into the shadows and remained motionless until the trailing surveillance vehicle passed. A concealment cavity built into the car's dashboard or floor mat was used to hide the package until the driver and vehicle returned to a safe compound. A higher risk variation of the moving car delivery occurred when the agent and handler both drove vehicles to the same traffic signal and pulled up alongside each other. With the agent's car on the right and the passenger window of the handler's car opened, the agent tossed the package into the empty seat. A moving car exchange required thorough planning and excellent timing, but when executed properly, was virtually undetectable. Impersonal communications, those not requiring face-to-face meetings, were employed when personal meetings were excessively risky or impossible. Impersonal communications separated the agent and handler by time, space, or location. During the initial phases of agent recruitment, face-to-face meetings between the case officer and target were often necessary, but would be phased out when the target accepted the clandestine nature of the relationship. The more hostile the operating environment, the greater was the need to shift to using impersonal communications to protect the agent. Impersonal communications using either dead drops or electronic devices offered advantages to the agent and handler, and when properly executed, were difficult for counterintelligence to detect. Dead drops avoided the necessity for the agent to possess an electronic transmission device, but required time-consuming surveillance detection runs by the handler. Conversely, electronic exchanges usually obviated the requirement for lengthy surveillance detection runs, but the technology could fail, and in its early years of use, often did. Other disadvantages to using impersonal communications included the handler being unable to directly assess the emotional and physical condition of the agent, and the communication stream being accidentally or intentionally interrupted or intercepted. Agents, as in the case of A.G. Tolkachev, could also decide the electronic gadget was unwieldy and stop using it, or that the amount of information passed during any one electronic transmission was too limited. Dead drops are the most commonly used and most secure form of impersonal communication. Dead drops enable agent and handler to exchange messages, correspondence, documents, film cassettes, money, requirements, and instructions without a direct encounter. Dead drops were timed operations in which the dropped package remained in a location for only a short time until retrieved by either the agent or handler. Dead drop sites are selected from locations to which both the agent and the handler have normal access. Public sites for dead drops ranged from parks and nature trails to stairwells, parking garages, and elevators. Site selection varied depending on the country in which the operation was taking place and the circumstances surrounding the agent. Examples might include a library that contained a shelf of little-used books, or the door of a mosque where shoes of either the agent or handler would serve as the container for the material being exchanged. Private areas, such as social clubs and health clubs, were also used if they contained obscured areas where drops could be left without notice. The ideal dead drop site was used only once, was in a location that could be precisely communicated to the agent, and provided speed of access for both the agent and handler. The site should also provide privacy so that it could be loaded and emptied without the agent and handler being observed. Finally, the location would be selected so that both the handler and the agent had plausible reason to be at the site and in a setting where the concealment would naturally pass unnoticed. A case officer from the 1970s who handled Polish officer Ryszard Kukliński observed, "Every CIA officer serving in a denied area should have a dog." Even in areas with constant and unfriendly surveillance, the necessity of taking the dog for walks provided excellent cover for carrying out operational acts involving signal sites and dead drops. In most capital cities, such as Moscow, Vienna, Paris, Washington, and Berlin, the number of pristine sites that met operational requirements for dead drops was limited, since thousands of intelligence officers from different countries had worked the same areas for decades. As a result, there was continuous pressure to identify new sites for future operational use. Techs and case officers shared the responsibility to find, photograph, sketch, and maintain inventories of valid sites. The difficulty in doing so was compounded because all signal and drop sites possess the same general attributes. In response, alert counterintelligence officers could set up an observation post at likely locations and patiently wait for them to be used. Nevertheless, the value of dead drops, despite their complexity and limitations, makes them a primary tool of every professional intelligence service. Signal sites were among several methods used to initiate a communication sequence between the agent and handler. Signals of some type usually preceded or concluded an operation and were normally linked to a specific meeting place or dead drop location. For example, a signal left at site Alpha may initiate a drop at site Bravo or a meeting at a designated park bench. Signal sites were usually located in public places, away from the actual drop site, and positioned so that the agent or a designated observer passed them regularly. Signposts, telephone poles, bridge abutments, and mailboxes were among the sites typically used to place a signal. Visual signal marks were made using postage stamps, white adhesive tape, masking tape, colored thumbtacks, colored adhesive-backed stickers, colored chalk, lipstick, and even crushed cigarette packs. A precisely placed soft drink can is readily visible to a passing car, bus, or pedestrian and becomes an effective signal. The positioning of the tape or the color of the thumbtack, chalk, or other signal could also send a danger signal or initiate an escape sequence. Even if the chalk mark was observed, its meaning was unknown to anyone other than the agent and handler. Usually after placing the material at a dead drop site, a signal was left to communicate that the drop had been loaded. The person unloading the drop would then confirm the presence of the signal before proceeding to the site. Once he had retrieved the materials or cleared the drop, a final signal might be left to communicate that the package was safe and the operation concluded. The absence of valid signals indicated a problem and forestalled either the agent or handler from approaching the site. Priority was always given to creating a safe and secure means for the agent to both send and receive messages. Signals were forms of codes that used symbols to communicate longer meanings. Other types of signal techniques included a car park signal, based on the direction a car was parked, its parking location, or the direction its wheels were turned, and a window signal that used the raised or lowered position of a window or drapes and blinds, open, partially open, or closed, to send a message. The position of a potted plant visible to passers-by could also have been a signal, depending on where it was positioned. Calls placed through the public telephone system, while subject to monitoring, could be safely used to send signals. An example was a silent call or dead telephone signal that was received at the agent's home at a predetermined time. The caller, using a public phone in a non-alerting location, said nothing but remained on the line for a set number of seconds before hanging up. To the agent, the call had meaning, but to anyone monitoring the agent's telephone lines, the call had no significance. Even if it was traced to the public telephone, it could not be linked to a case officer. When executed carefully and used infrequently, the silent call or other wordless signals were almost impossible for an adversary to decode. Other impersonal exchanges may be undertaken using public systems such as the postal service, telephone, telegraph, newspapers, radio transmissions, and the internet. Within public systems, covert communications are mixed with the billions of daily telephone calls, letters, postcards, telegrams, newspaper ads, emails, web postings, and instant messaging transmissions. When personal meetings were required, a technique known as a visual recognition signal could safely send a coded message from the agent to handler prior to any personal contact. Typically, the agent would be instructed to appear at a busy intersection at a prearranged date and time, wearing clothing whose color was meaningful to the handler, but not alerting to counterintelligence if he was under surveillance. Anyone aware of the operation and familiar with the agent's photo and instructions could observe from a distance to see if a properly attired individual appeared at the established time. Secret writing has existed for at least 2,000 years, and predates the establishment of the first European postal systems. Letters and postcards mailed by an agent to an accommodation address outside the country of origin were commonly used throughout the 20th century to conceal secret writing. The technique represented an early form of steganography in which the goal was to mask the existence of a communication. The CIA used three forms of secret writing: wet systems, dry systems, and microdots. Wet systems used special inks that became invisible on the paper after the writing dried. The hidden message became visible again only when a reagent matched to the ink was applied. As a simple example, lemon juice was used to constitute an ink, and the heat from an electric light bulb or candle as the reagent. OTS packaged dehydrated, heat-sensitive inks in a variety of disguised forms. Aspirin tablets made good candidates as concealment hosts because they were commonly carried and could be stored in a medicine cabinet at the agent's home without attracting attention. When dissolved in water, the pills created the ink. The agent dipped a sharpened wooden stylus or toothpick into the liquid and wrote on bond paper he had prepared by rubbing with a soft cloth in all four directions. Agents were instructed to write on paper placed on glass to prevent indentations and minimize the disturbance to the fibers in the paper. After the letter had been composed and the ink dried, the agent would again rub the paper in all four directions to eliminate any traces of the message in the paper's fibers. Later, the letter would be steamed and placed inside the pages of a thick book to dry. Agents would prepare a cover letter over the secret writing for mailing to an accommodation address outside of their home country. While it was most often used as an agent-send system, in some instances, agents also received instructions by secret writing. To eliminate the complexity of developing the writing and minimize the amount of potentially incriminating reagents in an agent's possession, OTS often recommended the scorch method. Polish military officer Ryszard Kuklinski received innocuous letters that contained hidden messages that became legible only when they were scorched with a household iron. With thousands of potential combinations of inks and reagents to select from, OTS produced hundreds of such systems. In an emergency, however, diluted blood, semen, and even plain water could be used as an invisible ink. Two weaknesses of wet systems were the requirement for the agent to possess the special ink and the near impossibility of removing all traces of damage to the paper's fibers. Even if the secret ink was not detected, under close scrutiny, the damage to the fibers of the paper sometimes became noticeable. Dry systems began appearing in the late 1950s as a variation of carbon typing paper. Chemists impregnated special papers with small amounts of chemicals and bound them into common items like writing journals, end papers of books, or the last few pages of notepaper in a checkbook. The agent would sandwich three pieces of bond paper on top of a piece of glass. The top and bottom papers were blank, while the middle page was the special carbon paper. The agent wrote the operational message on the top page, and the secret chemicals were transferred onto the bottom page. These dry systems quickly became the preferred method of secret writing in the 1960s. Former MI6 officer Richard Tomlinson described a modern dry system developed by the British service. Using the Pentel rollerball pen provided by Technical and Operations Support Secret Writing, I wrote up the intelligence in block capitals in the standard format of a CX, Raw Intelligence, report. It all fitted onto one page of A4 paper from my pad of water-soluble paper. Putting the sheet face up on the bedside locker, I laid a sheet of ordinary A4 paper over it, then on top of both of them. 5 minutes was enough for the imprint transfer to the ordinary A4. The sheet of water-soluble paper went into the toilet bowl, and in seconds, all that was left was a translucent scum on the surface of the water that I quickly flushed away. Back in the bedroom, I took the sheet of A4, folded it into a brown manila envelope, and taped it into the inside of a copy of the Gazzetta dello Sport. The simple but effective system eliminated the concern of the officer being detected with spy gear, since the Pentel rollerball was commercially available and uncompromising. The technique allowed the agent to see what he was writing before making the offset copy. Tomlinson observed that, Offset is now used routinely by MI6 officers in the field for writing up intelligence notes after debriefing agents, and is also issued to a few highly trustworthy agents, but is considered too secret to be shared with the liaison services, such as the CIA. Tomlinson also described a method for developing the Pentel secret writing. At the back of the pad, I ripped out the fifth to last page, took it to the bathroom, placed it on the plastic lid of the toilet seat, and removed a bottle of Ralph Lauren Polo Sport aftershave from my sponge bag. Moistening a small wad of cotton with the doctored cologne, I slowly and methodically wiped it over the surface of the paper. The message started to appear, darkening to a deep pink. Using the hotel hairdryer, I quickly dried the damp sheet, trying not to wrinkle it too much, and drying away the strong smell of perfume. It now looked a normal letter, though in a slightly peculiar dark red ink. Microdots and other reduced image techniques represented a third form of secret writing. A microdot was an optical reduction of a page of text or photographic negative to a size that was illegible without intense magnification. Commonly defined, microdots were less than 1 millimeter square and required optical magnification of at least 100 times to be read. The microdot's larger cousin, a macrodot, created with similar photographic reduction processes, was considered much less secure. Operational advantages to using microdots included their tiny size, which made it possible to conceal the dot inside a variety of hosts, and convenience of delivery to virtually any place in the world using public systems such as the Postal Service. CIA case officers received familiarization training in microdot communications, but making and burying an operational dot required assistance from an OTS specialist possessing both the necessary equipment and practice skills. Dots were usually the last choice for Agent Kovcom. There were also operational disadvantages to using microdots. The production and burying of a dot by the originator was exacting and time-consuming. Microdots were often so well concealed, they were difficult for the agent to find in the host letter or document. When located, the microdot had to be carefully dug out and properly positioned for reading. Microdots required special optical viewers with sufficient magnification to make the message legible. Other dots had to be redeveloped before they could be read. Microdots were usable primarily as a one-way agent-receive system. The lack of agent photographic skills, equipment, and training for microdot preparation most often precluded their use as an agent-send system. Microdot preparation usually required specialized photography equipment that, if discovered in an agent's possession, would arouse suspicion of espionage. For additional secrecy, microdots could be rendered invisible by bleaching in a small amount of diluted iodine before use. The process was reversed by redeveloping the dot after being received. The tiny bleached dot could be buried behind a postage stamp, the flap of a letter, inside the thickness of a postcard, or underneath a raised typed letter on a single sheet of paper. TSD manufactured a special slitter for slicing an opening on a postcard or raising a tiny flap on a piece of paper so that a microdot could be inserted. Once placed inside, the dot was sealed in place with a dab of egg white, carefully rolled with the curved edge of a glass to pick up excess glue, and placed beneath a stack of books to dry. When properly prepared, a microdot could be buried so effectively that it defied detection, even when a counterintelligence service was alerted and searching for it. Often, ensuring that the microdot could be found by the agent at its destination was a greater challenge than finding ways to conceal and transport the dots. After an agent dug out his microdot, he required a reader of sufficient power to read the message. Since a microscope might appear out of place inside the living quarters of many agents, OTS issued 3 small, concealable microdot readers. The smallest was the bullet lens, also known as the Stanhope lens. This tiny lens, a thin glass rod, 3 millimeters by 6.8 millimeters, slightly larger than a pencil lead, had a spherical convex curvature on one of its surfaces and a polished plane surface on the opposite side. The microdot could be moistened with saliva and affixed on the flat side of the lens. The user held the opposite side next to the eye. The bullet lens